Good morning. Recently, I heard three different people make connections or links between states of mind or practice that just kind of stopped me cold in my tracks. And so I want to talk about those three statements, those three connections today. And the first one, somebody linked loving-kindness and concentration. And the second one was concentration and equanimity. And the third one was equanimity and nirvana. And so I'm mostly going to talk about concentration and equanimity, but I want to talk about those three combinations today. So the first one was about, it was a little bit after Rahatsu, so maybe it was about a month ago. I was listening to a Dharma talk online. It was Sharon Salzberg was speaking, and she's an insight meditation teacher. She talks a lot on loving kindness and compassion. And excuse me, the statement that she made was, as she was talking about loving kindness, she said, "You know, loving kindness is a concentration practice." And it just kind of stopped me for a minute there, because I've been doing loving kindness and compassion practices for about 12 years or something, and I don't think it had ever crossed my mind that those were that they required concentration. So we do guided loving kindness meditations here on Saturday mornings. And next month, actually, is Guy here? Next month, Guy is leading our one-day retreat, and he's going to be talking about loving-kindness and also doing a loving-kindness guided meditation. So it's something we do around here. And when we do a loving-kindness meditation, we're generating goodwill and sending it out to people, to others. And a real common way to do it is to express, may so-and-so be happy, may they be healthy, may they be safe and protected, may they live in peace. And when you're doing it on your own, it is kind of easy to get off the mark with it, after I thought about what she had said. You know, it's not so hard to go from may so and so be safe and protected to, you know, she could take a little bit more risk in her life. You know, she might be playing it a little bit too safe. I wonder if she'd like to go rock climbing. We could go, you know, and imagine yourself, you're sitting here, you're like this or something. We could go rock climbing. We could go to Taylor's Falls. I heard they have classes there. I wonder if I'm related to the Taylors from Taylor's Falls. My Taylors are from Illinois, but, you know, there might be some connection. And, you know, like, what did that take? Half a minute? Went from, may my good friend be safe and protected, to the migratory patterns of the Taylor family in the 19th century. So it's easy to get off on some oddball track. And after I thought about it for a while, I thought, she's absolutely right. Loving kindness is a concentration practice for those of us who might need that kind of practice. And about a week after that, I was online again. I was listening to an interview on Ted Meisner's website. He's got this wonderful website called thesecularbuddhist.com that I highly recommend. And he was interviewing a guy named Tony Bernhard. And Tony Bernhard made the... Come on in. There's seats. There's a seat over there. There's a cushion there. Yeah. So, Tony Bernhard is a meditation teacher. I think he's also an insight meditation teacher. I think he's from California. But Ted was interviewing him, and he made the statement, Nirvana equals equanimity. He said it just like that. Nirvana equals equanimity. And I had to click pause, you know, after he said that. And think about it. And I listened to what he said, and then I had to, you know, I guess you don't rewind on a computer. What do? You move the thing over. Went back and listened over again. And he talked about nirvana as being a process or a state of mind. He said nirvana is being fully engaged with the pleasant and the unpleasant, the absence of greed and aversion. So he was making the point that this is different from an earlier vision of what nirvana was, you know, getting off the wheel of rebirths. That he thought of it not as being a transcendent state, but this process and this state of mind. So, you know, when I go out, once in a while I'll go out and talk to world religions classes, and nirvana is one of those things we always have to talk about, because they always confuse it with heaven, almost always, and they always ask about that. And I think it's because when they're taught in world religions classes, when they teach nirvana, they are taught of it in that way of being released from the cycle of rebirths. So we have to talk about nirvana not being a place, not being somewhere you go, and being a state of illumination, maybe, or liberation, in which you aren't bound by the three poisons, you know, greed, hatred, and ignorance. And when you describe nirvana that way, it's very close to a description of equanimity. My favorite definition of equanimity is maintaining inner equipoise in the face of anything. Peacefulness, even when there is no tranquility. I like that part in particular. Peacefulness, even when there is no tranquility. Reminds me of the Heart Sutra. Wisdom beyond wisdom. So, it's not being undone when you're confronted with the eight worldly winds. Lee Lewis has given a couple of talks over the past few years about the eight worldly winds. I just saw them also called the eight confining concerns, because they're the concerns that keep us from maintaining our equanimity. And the eight worldly winds are gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. So when we cannot become knocked over by those, when we cannot be, you know, grasping for gain and backing away from loss, when we can maintain the same mind state during fame as we have during disgrace, that would be equanimity. When Tim was talking about Sisyphus last week, he was talking about Sisyphus, you know, pushing that rock, rolling that rock up the hill to the top of the hill, and then it would stay there for, I don't know, you know, maybe about this long, and then it would roll back down the hill. And I thought about equanimity when he was telling that story, and imagining Sisyphus having the wherewithal to, as he's pushing the rock up the hill, to just push the rock up the hill, you know. And then when he gets it to the top, you know, you can stop maybe and go and stretch out a little bit, but not disappear into the, now I've done it, you know, not go overboard into the happiness part of it either. And when it starts rolling down, back down the hill, not get knocked off by that either. So it's not a state of indifference. Indifference is actually the near enemy of equanimity, the thing that it can be mistaken for. But being able to maintain that graceful state of mind, no matter where you are in that process. So, unfortunately for Sisyphus, I don't think he was able to maintain that. I want to read you a story from... It's actually from the sutras. It's a story about Buddha. And he was staying in the bamboo grove, and a Brahmin, and with all of his followers around him, and a Brahmin came up and started to insult him. And this Brahmin's name, I can't pronounce his name, but actually it translates to the insulter. So I don't know if that was his nickname or what, but he had a reputation apparently. So Buddha's there in the bamboo grove with his followers. And angered and displeased, the insulter went to the Buddha and on arrival insulted him and cursed him with rude, harsh words. And I have to go off on a tangent here for a minute. The first time I ever heard this, I thought, he insulted the Buddha? He insulted the Buddha? Really? I thought, did he not know this was the Buddha? You know, maybe I've lived in Minnesota too long. I don't know. But he insulted the Buddha. And but it points out something that I actually kind of like about the Buddha, which is that he was not a god. You know, he didn't have a halo, and he didn't levitate. And he didn't, you know, walk around wearing golden robes. He was just a man. He was fully human, not divine. And I like that about him. I think it's an important thing to keep in mind about the Buddha. The other thing is that at that time, there were a lot of spiritual leaders wandering around with their groups of followers. So there were a lot of them wandering around. That part of the world in those days. In the Kalama Sutra, it talks about how Buddha and his followers came into this town, and the people of the Kalama tribe came up to him and said, you know, we see a lot of people like you coming through here. We see a lot of these groups coming through, and how do we know which one has the true Dharma? How do we know which ones we should follow? How do we know which ones... which ones are worthy of our attention. That's a whole nother Dharma talk, what he said in response. But it tells me that to this Brahmin, to the insulter, the Buddha was just another one of these teachers with followers. And, you know, he couldn't have known that this is the one whose Dharma was still going to be taught 2,500 years from now. Which is not to let the Brahmin off the hook. Which is not to say, well, you could have insulted all those other guys, but Buddha... because if he hadn't met Buddha before, and if he hadn't... lived another couple of hundred years into the development of Mahayana Buddhism, he wouldn't have understood that everyone is Buddha. And I think that if he had encountered that teaching, it might have helped him a little bit with his irritation problem. But a lot of times we don't see that the person in front of us is Buddha. You know, I was in a department store one time with an elderly Buddhist teacher, and the clerk didn't understand his accent and was kind of impatient with him and a little bit insulting, and I was standing over here because, you know, I was just the driver, and I was just so astounded. I thought, you know, does that clerk not know who this is? It reminded me, you know, when you're out and about, that you do forget that everybody is Buddha. You forget, you know, that's somebody's grandma. You forget. So I'm not letting the insulter off the hook, but it really did stop me that he didn't realize he was talking to Buddha. That's the end of my tangent. Back to the story. So he insulted him and cursed him with rude, harsh words. And when this was said, Buddha replied, "What do you think, Brahman? Do friends and colleagues, relatives and kinsmen come to you as guests?" He answered, "Yes, they do." And Buddha said, "Do you serve them with staple and non-staple foods and delicacies?" And he said, "Yes, sometimes I serve them staple and non-staple foods and delicacies." I love this language. And Buddha said, "And if they don't accept them, to whom do those foods belong?" And he said, "If they don't accept them, those foods are all mine." And then the Buddha said, "In the same way, Brahman, that with which you have insulted me, who is not insulting, that with which you have taunted me, who is not taunting, that with which you have berated me, who is not berating, that I don't accept from you. It is all yours, Brahman. It is all yours." So he didn't accept it. He just handed it back. And when I read that, I thought, well, sure, he can do that. He's Buddha. Of course he can do that. But you know, could we do that? Could a mere mortal do that? You know, I mean, as easily as you could say, oh, you know, no appetizers tonight, no thanks. You keep them. It was a very, I thought it was a very impressive answer. And I saw it done once in practice. I was at another Zen center, and they had invited a guest teacher into town and for a talk, and she was in a large room that was full of people. And first the host teacher, the head teacher for the place, gave about a half an hour talk, and then the guest teacher spoke for probably another 45 minutes or an hour. And during the question and answer period, somebody who was expressed her displeasure and unhappiness with the talk in pretty insulting terms. And I don't remember anything that anybody said about that night. But what I remember was that she was very insulting, and the head teacher answered first. And he was very zen-like. He had done his work. He was very zen-like in his answer. But you could hear the defensiveness in his answer. It was just the tone. You could just hear it. And you felt for him. And then the guest speaker also answered her without a trace of anything angry in her voice, without anything defensive in her voice. She answered the concerns and the displeasure just very forthrightly. And with great equanimity, I thought. And I was so impressed by that. I was so impressed by that somebody could maintain their poise like that in front of a large room full of strangers and not lose it. And I thought, I want to be like that. I want to get me some of that. How does she do that? So I think with equanimity, as with so many things, the first thing that we need is a role model, somebody who can show us, you know, that it can be done. Sort of even to raise that aspiration above, well, sure, the Buddha can do it. Well, now, sure, I saw this woman do it, and she was amazing. So the question still remains, how do we go about developing equanimity? And Pema Chodron had a good answer to that. She's an American woman who is a nun in the Tibetan tradition, and the abbess of an abbey in Nova Scotia. And she said, to cultivate equanimity, we practice catching ourselves when we feel attraction or aversion before it hardens into grasping or negativity. So we practice catching ourselves. And then she went on to say, when we become really intimate with our own feelings and our own aversions and our own known, you know, the ways that we know that we react to things, then we can see more clearly and more easily how easily we become hooked, how we become hooked by those feelings, and we can step in before we react to them, and from that we can get a larger perspective. So that was her recommendation for how to cultivate equanimity. So that was Tony Bernhard's Nirvana Equals Equanimity. And I just thought that one was a very interesting pairing, especially coming right after Sharon Salzberg. So that was probably about 3 weeks ago that I heard that. And then a couple of weeks ago somewhere, and I cannot remember where and I can't track it down, I heard somebody say, concentration is equanimity. And by this time I was almost listening for these things, you know. But concentration, from a Buddhist point of view, in a Buddhist point of view, is single-pointedness of mind. And it's where all of our mental faculties are directed onto one particular object. So in meditation, that particular object might be a traditional one that we use a lot here is concentrating on the breath. Or you might concentrate on a mantra, you know, or koans, teaching stories. You might meditate on physical sensations, especially at the end of a 40-minute sitting. You might do that. You might use something like a candle flame. So in that single-pointed concentration, as thoughts and feelings arise, which they do because we're human, we can see them as they're arising. And when we do that, we just turn our mind back to the task at hand, which is concentrating on whatever it is that we're concentrating on. Concentrating on the breath, concentrating on the mantra, concentrating on the candle flame, whatever it is. So it's not that in concentration practice, necessarily, thoughts and feelings don't arise. It's that as soon as they do, you catch them and you bring yourself right back to that thing that you're concentrating on. Again and again. The Buddha talked about keeping our minds secluded from the five hindrances when we were doing in concentration. The five hindrances being negative mental states that can impede our meditation and actually lead us away from equanimity. So the five hindrances are sensual desire. I think of this one as the, boy, wouldn't it feel good to have a pashmina shawl around me right now while I'm meditating. So sensual desire or ill will. You know, the person who's sitting next to me is fidgeting and I can't stand it. So ill will. Sloth and torpor. I'm really wiped out this morning and I think I'm just going to sit here like a bump for a while. Or the opposite of that, restlessness. I'm too antsy. I should not have had that cup of coffee before I sat down. And the last one is doubt. What am I doing here? Some of us who were here for the half-day session yesterday morning that started at 10 till 6 might have had that thought at about 6:15. What am I doing here? So the five hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. And the Buddha talked about keeping our minds secluded from them. I like that. Keeping our mind secluded from those things so that our meditation can stay on track. And we cultivate concentration by our meditation practice, you know, by those minutes and days and years that we sit and over again bring our minds back, bring our minds back. We can also, you know, we talk about using our meditation practice to improve or make changes in our daily life. You know, when you get up off the cushion, you can still maintain your mindfulness. You can, but you can also practice concentration when you're off the cushion to help yourself when you are on the cushion, when you don't have any other distractions. Riding the bus is a really good one. You know, put down the phone, put down the book, and just find a point of concentration. There's usually one on the seat right in front of you. And you can practice a concentration in your daily life, too. In Zen, particularly in Soto Zen, our practice is Shikantaza, which means just sitting. And in Shikantaza, we're not focusing on one thing. We're not focusing on one thing. Tim has called it, I like this, panoramic awareness, having a panoramic awareness of everything around you. So everything that arises, we are fully and actively present to what's going on. And we just don't get caught up in it. So that's different than a concentration practice. And it's also not so easy to do, I think. As hard as concentration practice is, Shikantaza, just sitting, I think is a little more difficult. So when I teach people meditation, I usually teach them concentration practice to start off with. We'll talk about Shikantaza, but we'll start off with watching the breath. And if watching the breath is too hard, you know, counting the breath as a concentration practice. So, and in that concentration, I think this the speaker, whoever it was, that said concentration is equanimity. I think what they were saying was that in that concentrated mind, you can find that equipoise, you can find that equanimity if you are letting go of all of the other distractions that come up, that the equanimity will arise. I think that's what the speaker was talking about. Developing concentration practice, as I said, it's just like Pema talked about with equanimity. It's a matter of catching ourselves before we go off somewhere. It's a matter of catching ourselves and bringing ourselves back over and over again. It helps, I think, to sit down with intention. When you very first sit down, say, I'm really going to work on concentration today. And then exercise, and then it takes, if you're going into the practice of developing concentration, I think it takes some restraint and some real effort. So it's not that effortless kind of meditation that we talk about, because it does take that certain amount of restraint to bring yourself back. When we're in retreat here, when I'm leading a retreat, people come upstairs and have private discussions about how it's going. And lack of concentration is one of the things that I hear most commonly from people. You know, I cannot concentrate. My mind is all over the place. I can't still it down. You know, I can't make it shut up. And that's one of the things that I hear most often. And if it's a retreat that lasts several days or more, as the days go by, if they come back several days later, they often say something like, "I'm settling down." You know, "I'm settling down." And so what they're talking about is that they're developing concentration. But that's how they describe it. But from my point of view, when they come in, what I see is equanimity. You know, they're talking about how it feels to them, but what it looks like is equanimity. It just doesn't get described in those terms usually. Here's the Buddha again. Buddha said, "Now what, monks, is noble right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions?" He said, "Any singleness of mind equipped with these seven factors, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness, is called noble right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions." So what he was talking about there, those seven were the first seven on the Eightfold Path, concentration being the eighth. And what he was saying was that in that sutra, he was saying that the first seven are the supports for right concentration, and its requisites, or the things that it needs or depends on to become developed. You know, when we think about the Eightfold Path, since they are numbered, we tend to think of them in order. You know, right view, right resolve, right speech, right thought, ending up with concentration. But the last three, effort, mindfulness, and concentration can also, I think, be viewed as the foundation for the others. Because if you settle yourself into concentration with great effort, and you do that practice, the meditative practice, the mindful practice, that's taught, you will develop action, speech, livelihood, resolve, intention. I think they come along. I think that they also grow out of the concentration parts of the Eightfold Path. And in the same way that the divine abodes reside on equanimity. Loving kindness that I talked about earlier is the first of the divine abodes. So the divine abodes are loving kindness, compassion. It just flew right out of my mind. Sympathetic joy, thank you. And equanimity. And loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, I think you can understand how they would rest on the foundation of equanimity. Without equanimity, they might dissolve into a little bit too much nicey-nice, or maybe compassion might slip into pity, but equanimity holds them. It holds them up. So, I want to read you something that came in the October 2011 issue of Ink on the Cat. This is a publication from the Zen community of Oregon. Got it last October. And there's an article in here by Laura Jomon Martin, who is now my good friend. She became my good friend when I read this. I've never met her, and she hasn't met me, but I really liked this. The article is called Jomon's Greatest Hits. And she's talking about when she first sat down in meditation, you know, she really noticed her lapses in concentration after they happened. You know, she would wander off somewhere and end up wondering whether the tailors of Illinois were related to the tailors of of Minnesota or something. She and then it was it wouldn't be until minutes later that she realized that she had gone off. But after a while, she began to start noticing those lapses in concentration as they were happening. And with even more practice, she started being able to see thoughts and feelings as they were arising and catch herself before she would go off down whatever mind road it was, which freed her up to see things differently. And she realized how many repetitive thoughts she was having, how they were the same old thoughts all the time. And she started calling those repetitive thoughts, feelings, and body reactions her greatest hits. So during one session, I thought she had said after one session, but during one session, she organized the ones that visited her all week in outline form. So she put them in an outline. This is why I like Laura. I want to meet her someday. Roman numeral 1. What is everybody going to think of me? 1A, oh my God, I'm doing it wrong. Under oh my God, I'm doing it wrong, she had rehearsing future conversations and replaying past conversations. Under those, embarrassment about or dwelling on how they did not go well, embellishing or rewriting how I wish they had gone. So this is where her mind is going during session, during retreat. Roman numeral 2, judging, making up stories about others, self-judging, and guilt about judging. And Roman numeral 3 is miscellaneous, repetitive songs, thoughts, sudden thoughts of hilarity, and sudden thoughts of catastrophe. So when I read that, it was such a relief to know that I'm not the only one. I think that's the reason that we have to tell other people things like that, so that we all understand that we aren't the only ones who go off like that. And I think also that shining that light on it can remove the sting. Shining that light, and she was teasing herself a little bit, laughing about how she would get off on the status of tectonic plates and weather changes on planet Earth. So I think that understanding what they are, noticing them, making a little light of them can help you. It can reduce the sting of them, and it can help you turn away from them quicker and bring yourself back to your concentration. So those are the three comparisons that I heard recently. Loving kindness is a concentration practice. Nirvana equals equanimity. And concentration is equanimity. And I'm going to keep thinking about them, because I think there's a lot more there. But at this point, I guess I'm more interested in what you have to say about them. Anybody have anything they want to say about those, or something else? A question do you want to ask? Test my equanimity, anybody? Not you, Kate. Hi, Kate.
Edgar Quinn sort of touched on and referenced the importance of humor and of, like, being able to not make light of these kinds of things that come up and how important that is. And that's something I've definitely found, because otherwise, you know, it allows you to let go of them and not sort of cling to them and sort of judging, and then it sort of, you know, the death spiral begins, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered that when I first started meditating, when I would spin off like that, and I would realize that my body was here and my brain was in the, you know, I wonder if I'm related to kind of crazy,
mm-hmm.
I called it Elvis had left the building.
There you go.
And that, the first time I thought of that, it just cracked me up. And it really was just, and it allowed me to just say, like, okay, back to the building, you know.
I think I was sitting next to you during that retreat. Was that the time when you were...
I probably was thinking Elvis had left the building. But, you know, that But having that way of being able to—that's an important part of equanimity to me—is being able to make light of things that you could make a big deal of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how it starts that kind of, that, you know, what I call the death spiral, where it's, now,
yeah,
now it's about, oh, you know, I've wandered off. I'm a bad meditator. What am I going to do? How am I going to fix this? And, you know, and it's this whole other thing where it's just judging. Whatever,
and I think that's a good thing to bring into the practice. It's that lightness. Yeah, it takes the sting out of it, I think. Having been raised in an Irish Catholic home, I sort of learned that early. The more important something was to you, and the more dearly you held it, the more you got to laugh about it. And that was a wonderful lesson. So, Paul.
Yeah, I would just add a comment about Sisyphus. I remember reading about him in college, and that sort of stuck in my mind over the years. And one of the conclusions I came to about that story, about that fate, is that had he resigned himself to just sitting at the bottom of the hill and given up, that would probably be a worse fate than trying to roll the ball up the rock up the hill and get it there someday.
Mm.
Even if he knew that he was doomed not to succeed, at least he had hope that someday it might stay, or that somehow his fate might change.
Mm-hmm.
And because of his activity, he's probably likely to stay healthy.
That's true.
Despair is where it all falls apart.
Despair is where it falls apart.
And then there's sloth and acedia and everything else that will contribute to your demise. Because if you've given up hope, you'll just fail to do everything.
Yeah. And you know that that sitting at the bottom of the mountain and just kind of resting under the shadow of the rock and not doing it, that's indifference, and that's the near enemy of equanimity. It's something that may look like equanimity from the outside, but it isn't at all. Didn't he start out as a really angry man? What was it that there was something about why he was doomed to do that. It had something to do with him being angry. Anyway. Oh. I do. I saw it this week and I just really liked it. And I thought for a while about how can I work this into the talk, and then I just really like it, and I'm putting it on the bulletin. But there is a deep inner meaning in there that relates to what I said somehow. Now we are ready to look at something pretty special. It is a duck riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf, and he cuddles in the swells. There's a great thing heaving in the Atlantic, and he is a part of it. He can rest while the Atlantic heaves because he rests in the Atlantic. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you, but he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. So there's equanimity. He reposes in the immediate as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he has religion. So I like the part about the duck being equanimous in the middle of the ocean. And I also love the line, he reposes in the immediate as if it were infinity, which it is. There's something wonderful about that line. So sometimes the things that I put on the cover of the bulletin have a lot to do with what I'm talking about, and sometimes I just really like them. Anything else?
question about you know that is it the Metta Sutra that starts with I don't know if it's the photo of that thing, but it's the this is what should be done by those who
are. Oh my goodness, and you know the path of peace. That's the Metta Sutra. Yeah.
So what do you think about that with regard to what you just talked about?
A couple of Junes ago, I gave 3 days of talks on the Metta Sutra. There is so much in there. It is a wonderful sutra. It's the Buddha's instructions to the monks on how they should comport themselves, and particularly about loving kindness and compassion. And we chant that sutra the first and third Saturdays of the month. We do a formal service before sitting, and that's one of the sutras that we chant. And it's my particular favorite thing that we chant here ever. I highly recommend it. So, Oh. You can find it. It's in the the chant books are out on the porch. If you'd like to see it, talk to me afterwards. And or Kate's got a chant book out there, and you can take a look at it. It's really a lovely chant. I made a recording of myself chanting it, and I played it to myself when I was in the car when I was commuting for a while. It's just a wonderful chant. That's a great way, by the way, if you want to memorize something. How to do it. Martin's done that too, haven't you? Yeah.
I thought about that. It's like straightforward and gentle in speech, just that one line.
Mm-hmm.
What would be a good example? Or the woman who maintained equanimity from the person who wasn't very nice.
Yeah.
I thought of that line, straightforward and gentle speech. She seemed to really do that.
She was very straightforward. Yeah, I almost said she was kind, but she wasn't kind. She was straightforward. You know, she wasn't coddling the person in any way. She was just very straightforward. I think the other wonderful thing about chanting sutras is that they get down under your skin. They get down under your skin. And you keep finding layers and layers of meaning in them. And it was a wonderful thing, actually, for me to study the Loving Kindness Sutra, to give those 3 days of talks on it. Not 3 whole days of talks. Nobody would sit for that. 3 hour-long talks over 3 days. But it was a wonderful thing to go back and find out where each one of them came from and why he was telling the monks that and what that had to do with our lives. That one in particular. Yeah, let me see. A couple of years ago, and then on a Sunday, I kind of smushed all 3 of them into one Sunday. So it's on our archive somewhere under the Metta Sutra. I'm a big loving kindness kind of gal. John Lennon talked one time about how he was so into peace because he had not started off as a peaceful kind of guy. And that's why he got so into studying peace and talking about peace all the time, because he didn't feel like he came from there. And that's kind of how I got interested in loving kindness, too.